There are a few writers on this planet that I admire more than Hillel Levin, who I've known for many, many years. He was an editor in Detroit, of Detroit City Magazine, of the Chicago Magazine here, and has written a number of fascinating, fascinating books. The latest, which we will explore after Hillel and I go over his prolific and astonishing career, the latest is titled Submerged: A Cold Case, An Innocent Man Condemned, and One Family's Darkest Secret. It is chilling. It is the work of tireless investigative reporting on his part. And we will devote a large portion of this program to that book. But first, I want to talk about everything else in your life. Hillel, how are you?
Good. Great. Thanks for those kind words.
Well, I'm not just saying it. I've written about it a number of times, too. Hillel, what is it? It's something I've never talked to you about. What is it that drew you to writing in the first place, writing and editing?
Well, to be very honest, when I lived in New York City, I thought I'd be a book editor or work for a magazine, and I couldn't find a job. And I wrote articles. I had no journalism in my background. So basically, articles was all I could do to make a living. And I was given a break by some great people like Victor Navasky.
Oh, wow.
At The Nation. And then some editors at New York Magazine.
Did you have in these early days of freelance writing, believe me, as you well know, is one tough racket. Were you concentrating on anything? Arts, crime, law, politics?
It's funny. I mean, some of my best stories have found me for some coincidence of factors. And, for example, I one of those first articles I had was about a very bizarre character who was writing for right-wing publications and pretending to be an anti-war person. Mm. And he was in a file that the state police in New York State were using, like the Bible. And the individual who kind of broke that story open, his name was Bill Haddad. Just a fascinating guy, an investigative reporter, political person, investigator for the state legislators, speaker, and he actually came up with the idea of generic drugs, joint custody.
Wow.
Played a major role in bringing up Robert Moses. Fascinating, amazing person. And he ends up as a spokesman for John DeLorean. And he got me to talk to him. I was going to write what was going to be one of many pop pieces about his car company that he was starting with his Gullwing car.
Was this when you were working with Detroit Magazine, or was it before?
This was when I was in New York.
Oh, wow. Okay. And
then I end up in Detroit. I obviously, auto industry's big.
Yep.
And basically, I took another look at what DeLorean was doing with a stock prospectus. And I guess this is like the through line of my career. He was beloved by reporters.
Oh, I can imagine. Sure.
And he was an interesting guy. He was fascinating. More
colorful. He was married to a beautiful woman. Yes,
and all of that. And actually didn't do as much as he took credit for. But, was responsible for the youth movement in cars like the GTO. And I found he was a con man. From even in his earliest days in college. And what I ultimately uncovered was that he had taken about $14 million that the British money the British government had given him to build that car in Northern Ireland. And nobody picked that story up.
I know.
With a little tiny city magazine.
Yeah.
And then a year later, he's arrested with cocaine, and they're scurrying the planet for anyone who's ever written a negative article about him, and I'm on Nightline, if you remember that.
Absolutely.
Show.
And today, absolutely.
And I get a book contract, and that was my break. So,
well, that book
you
was.
Know, it's like not what you seek. And this has probably happened to you too. It's
sure.
The things that find you, and then you have this bizarre history of experiences and in some things you've written about that just come together perfectly for the story you're covering, which is kind of what happened with this latest book, Submerged.
Ugh, what a story. Believe me, we're going to spend the whole half hour you're on talking about it. It's just, it's riveting, as I thought most of your work is. Well, you've written a lot of books. The other one that intrigues me and that I've read, because it too is about a very compelling figure, a lawyer named Robert Cooley. The title of the book is When Corruption Was King. I know if you talk about him for a couple of minutes, people are going to go, oh, yeah, that guy.
Well, it's funny because what his investigation opened up, again, talking about conventional wisdom,
mm-hmm.
was far more damaging and insidious than Greylord.
Yeah.
It was important. I don't want to minimize it, but, you know, you had traffic court with Greylord.
Yeah.
With Cooley, you're talking about the longest-serving alderman. You're talking about the assistant, the senator, the minority leader of the Illinois State Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Not just criminals, and there were many mobsters he brought down, but also policemen, and the first judge, he opened up the case against, his name was Maloney, the first judge caught fixing a murder case.
Yep, yep.
So he had all these things, and yet he was considered a very arrogant, pompous individual. I thought the best way to tell the story was in his voice,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, is not really his voice. I mean,
right.
Everything I did. It's really like writing a monologue in a play, but, you know, trying to sound like he does and bring in description. But again, you know, it was a story that no one else wanted to do because,
right.
you know, Bob was a difficult human being.
Yes. How difficult.
And what it told me about organized crime in Chicago, again, another subject.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, people here may laugh, like, of course everyone knows there's organized crime. People don't know about organized crime in Chicago in the second half of the 20th century.
Right.
People don't know the name of Tony Accardo. People don't know he built Las Vegas.
Yeah.
This wasn't a New York thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Chicago thing. And his influence was, and the influence of what they call the outfit, was just incredible through our politics, through things like O'Hare Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, politics and construction and, incredible. Yeah.
Yes. And again, you know, very much against conventional wisdom, certainly, you know, editors in New York. So, but that opened my eyes to organized crime.
Yeah.
And, you know, which led me to other projects.
Well, it led you to talk about another one that I read. I think I reviewed it too. In with the Devil is a fascinating story. It was turned into a mini series. It's about a young man named not so young anymore, but a young man named Jimmy Keen. Who was a very sort of charismatic, was he a football player, wrestler? What was his sport?
Well, in high school, yeah. And yeah, but he went more into drugs than sports after he graduated high school.
Yes, well, became more lucrative. He wasn't getting any contract with any pro teams. How'd that story come to you, Hillel?
Well, it came to me through an individual who, you know, works with an attorney who helps people after they're sentenced, and he's almost like a prison concierge. He helps people get ready for the prison they're going to go into.
Sure,
and,
sure.
You know, provides a lot of good advice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's how I met Jimmy. what obviously his story is so bizarre and hard to believe it's true, that they wanted him to go to a federal prison that, again, nobody's heard of, in Springfield, Missouri, in the center of the country, built around Alcatraz, where they send, in those days, not anymore, psychiatric and severe medical federal prisoners with severe medical conditions. So Gotti died of cancer there. And they wanted him to go there, meet a guy, befriend him.
Befriend him,
who
yeah.
was suspected to be a serial killer, get him to confess that he killed this young woman in Indiana and say where he buried her.
Yeah.
And if he did all that, they were going to release him. He had been 10 months into his 10-year sentence for drugs. They were going to release him.
Yeah.
So it's almost like the witch's broomstick, you know, in The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
But somehow he did it. And but for me, I mean, there are a couple of things that I was obviously fascinated by this bizarre prison.
Oh, my God.
Because,
sure.
Which is mostly underground. For a while, this was going to be a movie with starring Brad Pitt as Jimmy Keane.
Ooh.
Because Brad Pitt is from Springfield, Missouri.
That's right.
And he grew up with that prison in the backyard, so to speak, wondering what the hell that thing was and who was there.
Mm.
But, you know, they put people on the Supermax, and then if in that state they still manage to kill people and maim guards, then where do they put them?
Right.
Where
right.
do you go
yeah, right.
to the Supermax? They would put them in Springfield. So, I mean, you know, some of the blind sheik, Larry Flint.
Yeah,
An 800-pound drug dealer that no cell is big enough for. just bizarre stuff. And when it was originally built, they thought they were going to cure criminality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was bizarre. But what really, for me, was a central theme of the book was this misperception about serial killers. The idea that there's these hovering people who are profilers from the FBI, and they come in and they swoop in and they say, oh, this is...
Yes, he's 34 years old. He never held a real job, and he lives with his mother.
And we know, exactly. None of it is true. When these things happen, it's the local police. And for the most part, they don't have any idea what a serial killer is.
Right.
It's like saying a UFO has landed in your backyard. And as a result of that, you know, this individual I wrote about, there's kind of an analogy that works for a lot of these guys. It's the Wolf Man.
Yeah.
Because he looked like the most gentle, harmless human being.
Mm-hmm.
But when he turned on it a dime and was extremely strong and obviously deadly.
Yeah.
But as far as the local police were concerned, he was, quote unquote, a wannabe. He wanted to be a serial killer.
Huh.
Some of these guys, they keep souvenirs from crimes they haven't committed. But this guy was also a custodian. He was just the most toxic, lethal individual you could ever hope for or hope against as a serial killer. So that, to me, is what opened up, you know, that whole thing with the story. And, of course, I looked at other, you know, cases.
Oh, of course.
Realized,
sure.
You know, Son of Sam, Gacy, you know, Gacy had all kinds of people who were almost victims who kind of went to report to the police. And because they looked gay or had long hair, they didn't take them seriously.
And they said, what, you were drinking with the...
Any profilers, Silence of the Lambs, all of that is
nonsense.
Really baloney.
Nonsense.
So, but, believe it or not, I mean, that's what I could say, how stories find you. Very early on, looking into the submerged case, this was a young woman named Raina Rison. She died in...
I'm going to stop you, Hillel. I'm going to stop you. We'll get to it. We got to go to the news, and I want to talk for 2 seconds when we come back about Assassination Theater, and then everything after that is about Submerged. I wrote about In with the Devil, I said it reads like a fast-paced suspense novel. That's the kind of writer Hillel Levin is. We will be back right after the news. Welcome back. I am on the phone for the rest of this program with Hillel Levin, who is the author most recently of Submerged, A Cold Case, An Innocent Man Condemned, and One Family's Dark Secret. Before we dive deep into that, he has written something else and produced something else that is fascinating and is about conspiracy and dark deeds. Assassination Theater, Hillel. Tell people what that was. I saw it like three times.
Well, it was, and believe me, I am not a conspiracy theorist
right.
in any way. I'm very
You're a reporter.
Focused on
yeah.
facts. But I was, through some of my writing about organized crime, I was introduced to an FBI agent who said to me, "You have to do the real story about the Chicago mob." And I said, "You know, what was that?" And then he said, "How they killed JFK."
Yeah.
And that started a 7-year journey.
Oh, I know.
Through all kinds of research. And again, it was guided by these retired FBI agents.
Mm-hmm.
Max Shelton was the one in particular. And they had some revelations. But for me, the biggest revelation was how much has been released. People say, well, when will they ever let these documents go? They have let them go. After that totally crappy and untrue movie, JFK,
oh my Lord,
Stone,
sure.
the Congress passed something called the JFK Act, and they released a lot. They released, I think, everything that we need to see.
Mm-hmm.
It was first cleared by a review board that worked for the National Archives to make sure they weren't revealing any national security. But amazing things came out of that.
Yeah.
And some of these things had been sealed back in 77 when the House Select Committee on Assassinations did interviews that they decided were just too toxic and too embarrassing for a very favorite former member of Congress,
mm-hmm.
who most people are amazed to hear had anything to do with the Warren Commission or the assassination investigation. And his name was Jerry Ford.
Yep.
And
yep.
Ford was in up to his neck. So why did I do a play? Let me say that. And then, you know, to cut to the chase about
sure.
the play. I just felt that after what I found, there was a lot of stuff that was also very visual. So if you
mm-hmm.
look,
mm-hmm.
for example, Dealey Plaza.
Absolutely.
See, you know, where yep. guns were fired from.
Mm-hmm.
Could actually see people, the individual I think is the assassin walking away, that would be very significant. But most importantly, having the undivided attention of two people, I mean, of people in a theater.
Yeah, yeah,
for
yeah.
2.5 hours is yep. what I meant to say.
No.
It was just the ideal way to get the yeah. across. Not
no.
just to have
Kate and I were among them, and we thought, is there a future for that? Is there a future for that show?
I don't know. I mean, I had an excellent director. I never understood until that experience how important directors
yeah.
are.
Yeah.
His name is Kevin Fox.
Oh, sure.
An excellent cast of actors. So one actor was me, believe it or not.
I do.
Another was Zach Shelton.
Mm-hmm.
And then the two other actors who had great accents played all the people, you know, from Hoover to Bobby Kennedy to some of the mobsters and all of the shady figures. And everything that they said was from an actual transcript
yep.
or a memoir
yep.
or
yep.
a government document. I did not put words into anybody's mouth.
Oh, I know that. That's
and
why.
To me, that was the most amazing.
And that's why I was so.
My experience with that.
So impressed. You can get 9, more information.
People saw it.
Yep. And more should see it. That's what I say. More should see it.
Yeah. I think the only way for it to live, because, you know, maintaining a
yeah.
play and
you know, it's tough.
Actors and
tough.
Stage manager and, yeah, all
yeah.
of it. and theater space is tough in Chicago.
Very.
Is for me to go out. I have tried going out, you know, with my slides and doing an abbreviated version of it.
Yeah, I would. I'd see it in any form.
That's the best way to.
In any form. In any form, in any place. You can get more about all the books we've talked about at Hillel's website, which is HILLELEVIN.com. It's a wonderful website. Okay, my writer friend, Submerged came to you how? This is such a sad, it's chilling on about 20 different levels to me. Submerged, yeah. A cold case, an innocent man condemned, and one family's darkest secret. You really did a yeoman's investigative reporting work on this. How did it come to you? How'd you hear about it?
Again, it kind of found me. So, among this individual we talked about, the serial killer and In With the Devil and Blackbird, his name was Larry Hall, that he had a number of suspected victims because, you know, they do keep lists of people they would have liked
yeah,
to kill.
Yeah, people I'd like to kill.
Untrue.
Yeah.
They it's like they collect souvenirs, or like a fan collects baseball cards.
Sure.
I mean, it's that bizarre and perverse. And he had this young woman who he lived in Wabash, Indiana, who only lived 2.5 hours away.
Mm-hmm.
But although I had him in the book as a suspect, when I looked into it, I just couldn't see, because he worked on his own, how he could have ever pulled it off. And there are other aspects to this young woman's death. Her name was Raina Rison.
Mm-hmm.
She is mentioned by name, unfortunately, in Blackbird, but they didn't ask me about
right.
that. And when I called to investigate that in, like, 2006, I got into the prosecuting attorney's office. Someone picked up the phone, and they said, no, it was not your serial killer.
Yeah, we know who it was, and he's in jail, right?
We know who it was. No.
Oh.
It was her brother-in-law. So, again, the murder was in 93.
Mm-hmm.
In 1989, her brother-in-law was caught and then later convicted when she went into a clinic looking for an abortion.
Mm.
He had molested and then impregnated her when she was 13.
Ugh.
And the family begged the judge not to put him in prison. He was supposed to take sex offender treatment classes, which I found out he rejected.
Mm.
And one of the therapists had warned his probation officer, this is a guy who's going to offend again.
What was his name? What was his name?
His name was Raymond McCarty.
McCarty. Mm-hmm.
McCarty. And when he was off probation and she was 16, she started to tell some of her closest friends he's doing it again. And so when she disappeared, so she was abducted from the parking lot of this animal hospital.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I mean, we often don't think of the victims when we tell these stories. This was just an incredible young woman.
Oh, you do such justice to her. You do.
Ahead of her.
Yeah.
I know, she was sweet. She was, you know, it's a very diverse population. This is in LaPorte, Indiana, kind of between South Bend and Michigan City.
Yeah.
It has people from all economic classes, especially when she was going to school there. She was friendly with everybody. She was had three jobs. She wanted to be a veterinarian, and this after-school job was at a veterinary clinic where she was, quote-unquote, the kennel girl.
Mm.
And as she was getting, she was the last one left, and as she was getting out, witnesses saw her abducted from that parking lot. This was in March 93.
Mm.
And then a month later, she was found 9 miles north, submerged in a pond.
Mm. We have to stop there. We'll pick this up in 2 minutes after a short break.
Okay.
It has taken Hill Levin roughly 20 years since he first came upon this sad, sad case of Rena Ricin, the killing of Rena Ricin, and an astonishing amount of investigative work. This was really, for you, Hillel, it must have been like unraveling a huge ball of twine.
Yeah, I mean, it. Like I said, every rock I turned over, something crawled out from under it.
And nothing, and nothing pretty. That's the other thing. Nothing pretty.
No. And, you know, unlike everything I've ever done, there are a couple of things at stake here. Namely, not just a man's freedom, mm-hmm. the person wrongfully convicted of Reyna's crime. We'll get to that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But his name, his good name.
Oh.
His name is Jason Tibbs. He'd stay in prison another year if he had to clear his name.
Oh.
That means more to him at this point than his freedom.
Mm.
And when, you know, my last publisher said to me, well, we don't really do exoneration books.
Ugh.
Because, boy, what if this guy ends up being guilty? It will be so embarrassing for us.
I hope they wouldn't say that if they'd read the book, but that's another matter.
When you pitched the idea. Before I even got into it.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I had to get
gotcha.
A publisher. And they said, well, when he gets out, you can write that book. And I said, he won't get out if I don't write the book.
Right.
So I ended up, as a result of that, with a small publisher. And they've done a very good job.
Very good.
Producing the book. I have no complaints about that. But, you know, just to pick up the thread here, this girl's brother-in-law was who they told me had killed her.
McCarty, yeah.
And, yes. And, in fact, it took them, because her family has always defended him.
Mm.
And what people find this so unbelievable.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, they had to take their time. They finally pulled in a grand jury. They do that rarely in that county of LaPorte. And indicted him.
Huh.
And then a year later, the charges were dropped.
Wow.
Okay, we can talk in a second about why the charges were dropped. But they had 70 witnesses. They had motive. Namely, his wife found out that Reyna was taking pregnancy tests.
Mm.
So if he had gotten her pregnant again, he would have gone away.
Wow.
Ray McCarty would have gone away a long time. So there's your motive.
Yep.
They had all this information from their friends. They had some fabric, you know, the kind of what they call trace elements that
mm-hmm.
were somewhat connected. But they never figured out the cause of death.
Mm.
And the autopsy said there were no signs of physical trauma on her body.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, this was maybe it got washed away, she decomposed. In fact, being in that pond over March in Northwest Indiana
preserved her.
At that point, was like she was in a refrigerator.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Preserved her, yeah.
So that wasn't the case. But because I had written about serial killers, I saw it immediately. I knew how she died. And then it didn't take me very long to connect that to McCarty.
Mm.
So there's mm-hmm. no way they would have dropped the charges if they had seen that or knew that. But that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
This bizarre history I have as a reporter, it immediately jumped out at me. And I, you know, maybe we won't go. That's kind of a spoiler, I guess.
Yeah, don't.
As to what? Because I, you know, once I did that, then I looked for truly years into every piece of paper, every police record that there were. There's more than a thousand. As I said, you know, they do these document dumps. I got it from Jason's lawyer.
Yeah.
And it's hundreds of pages, a lot of duplication. But I was able to follow up leads, and I did discover who the accomplice was. That was another thing they never figured out.
Mm.
And I was able to place the brother-in-law. His car was spotted very suspiciously in certain places. But more people saw the accomplice, who they described as a tall, skinny guy. The police looked at Ray's best friend, who was a big, fat guy, who I believe was part of the conspiracy but got cold feet. But I identify that accomplice, his own unusual story, who is dead, and I should say Ray is dead.
Yes.
And then, you know, really look through those police reports and found remarkable reports.
What kind of
through the cracks.
In trying to, and I am stunned and awed by your reportage and your investigative diligence and talent. What kind of closed doors did you encounter? What kind of sealed lips did you have to unseal?
Unfortunately, I mean, when I talked about Jason's reputation, this subject is so toxic.
Mm-hmm.
Even reporters didn't want to talk to me because, you know, let's skip ahead. Here I'm told that McCarty was a killer, that charges were dropped. And they shouldn't have been, and I agree they shouldn't have been. And then 2013, 20 years later, her middle school boyfriend is arrested a year later, convicted.
Mm. Mm.
And that's when I decided, I've got to look into this case. And while they had 70 witnesses in the grand jury that indicted McCarty, there are really just two
that mattered
with Jason.
You know, it strikes me, and you paint a really remarkable, I know La Porte a little bit, I know some people who live there, have for many years, and you say it's a city and a county of contrasts, from gritty urban industrial to bucolic lakes and forest preserves, from celebrity ranches to double-wide trailers and dilapidated shacks. The politics of that specific county are sort of in the business of being self-protective.
Rick, but also exactly, and it was a big part of the story. The reason the charges were dropped was a political vendetta.
Yeah,
the prosecutor who dropped the charge, the woman who oversaw the grand jury a few months later is up for re-election.
Mm-hmm.
The man who ran against her, she had fired, and so he went after two of her hallmark cases and dropped the charges without asking any of the investigators, without asking any of the prosecutors involved. He just dropped the charges and, again, pointed to these little things. They're not little things,
but
gaps that were in the investigation. Again, I believe that if it had gone to trial, Ray just did so many things like change his alibi all the time that showed consciousness of guilt, he would have been convicted. But this guy could kind of lean on that for an excuse.
Yeah.
And then there was another vendetta, which was the policeman who was the chief investigator against Jason and tried to get him on another totally crazy case that did get him fired. But they dropped the charges, and he just pursued the case against Jason with total tunnel vision and cherry picking, and then was aided by a state policeman who was supposed to oversee the investigation. And that was really the second half of the book is the scary thing. How do you convict a totally innocent guy?
Terrifying, yeah.
With no physical evidence other than a love letter he wrote her in the ninth grade.
Yeah.
When he asked if they could get back together.
It is just this.
And this is a guy who had he had a criminal history, you know, some financial things, a juvenile delinquency where he stole from the neighbor, but nothing sexually violent in any way.
Ugh.
And basically what you do is you start off with a jailhouse snitch.
Yep.
And this guy had found out through the newspaper that there's a chance to get your sentence reduced if you helped in these unsolved homicides. And he came up with this very crazy
that people should have doubted from the beginning.
Yeah.
His name was Ricky Hammond.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did was look into his murder case.
Sure.
Which Jason's lawyers never did. They just looked at the cursory story that appeared in the paper that you know, he killed his roommate and the roommate may have raped him. None of that was true. Wasn't a roommate. It was his landlord. It was this benefactor who did some wonderful things for him. And because he created damage in the house where they lived and he, and the benefactor wanted the money back, he shot him 10 times.
Wow.
7 times in the face, 3 times. Just a despicable guy. But you didn't have to look very far in that investigation to see his own sister say, oh, my brother, he's a pathological liar.
It shows to, you know, one of the other...
And this was the central witness against Jason.
One of the other leitmotifs of this, one of the other themes of this book is how remarkable politics and the justice system can conspire to send innocent people away. I mean, it is happening, as Hillel Levin will tell you, all over this country. But it takes someone like Hillel Levin to go into it in the depth and write about it in the strong, compelling narrative he does in Submerged. How a cold case condemned an innocent man to hide a family's darkest secret. I'm not going to tell you that it's the most joyful kind of Christmas gift, but it is certainly...
Well,
a book that,
I'll just say this in closing, and thanks again for your kind words.
My pleasure.
People who love true crime
always
complain to me about documentaries and books that they leave all these loose ends. And partly for Jason's sake, I was determined, and I promise you, there are absolutely
no loose ends.
3 years later,
I know.
Left no loose ends in the story. So.
You came through, Hillel Levin. H-I-L-L-E-L-L-E-V-I-N. More about this book, all of his books. Happy holidays to you, my friend. Happy holidays to you.